Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is hacker, tech futurist, and inventor Pablos Holman, who will deliver the University of Tulsa's presidential lecture tonight. Holman embraces the term hacker in its classic sense of breaking existing technology as a way of building new tech. He also embraces the term inventor, saying America needs more inventors, creating new technology over finding innovative ways to exploit or monetize existing technology. Over the years, he's built the world's smallest PC, 3D printers at MakerBot, spaceships with Jeff Bezos, and artificial intelligent agent systems. Today, he's an inventor and consultant with Nathan Myhrvold's Intellectual Ventures Laboratory, and he's working with the Gates Foundation on eradicating malaria, most spectacularly on a laser that can target malaria-carrying mosquitoes, but also on a super thermos that keeps vaccines from spoiling in areas without access to refrigeration, sophisticated mapping programs that can help public health officials hone in on areas where malaria outbreaks can be targeted before they occur. He's also involved in a project to build a nuclear fission reactor that runs on our copious amount of nuclear waste, a machine that can recycle ocean water to cool hurricane-prone waters, and a system to reverse global warming. He'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the University of Tulsa campus in a free lecture. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Pablos Holman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Your approach to innovation and technology is by taking a humanistic approach in designing and developing new technology. Something you say, most technology companies are really not taking that emphasis. A lot of times they're engaging in the shallow tech, taking existing technology and reusing it and readapting and hacking it, if you will, to create new products. Can you talk about that idea of developing technology as a humanistic exercise?
Yeah, I mean, I think that criticism comes from just seeing a lot of activity around that we call tech, and the whole tech industry is really just software. You know, we've had software for a long time, and there's certainly a lot of places to go with that and things that need to be done using software. But I don't think of that as technology so much anymore. You know, technology implies that you've got a hold of some new superpower that was invented, you know, something that hasn't been part of the toolkit before. And it gives you a chance to sort of reimagine really everything humans have ever done. You know, you get to ask yourself, does this change anything we're doing? Can we do it in a better way? Can we do it in a faster, cheaper, more humane fashion? Things like that. And so, you know, software is one of those tools in the toolkit, but the scientific community is doing basic research and learning more about the world all the time. And we're getting discoveries every day. Some of them, you know, you get hits, you get a chance to really change something. And so a lot of what I'm focused on is trying to advance that toolkit. That's kind of what invention is about. But then on the entrepreneurship side, you know, what I think is really important is to show people that it's those technologies that give you a force multiplier for going after big problems. And if you start, you know, you can start a company without any technology. I mean, you can, and that still counts as entrepreneurship. You know, you can go start a taco wagon and that counts as a new business, but you're not likely to make a bigger impact than any other taco wagon that came before you. So if you want to, you know, if you want to make a big difference in the world, you know, you want to start with the force multiplier that technology gives you as a tool. And so I'm really trying to spend some time, you know, helping people, you know, sort of demystify the technologies themselves, because those are, you know, that's where a lot of it starts. But then show what that process, what that life cycle looks like from basic research through discovery, through invention, into entrepreneurship, and on to, you know, so-called disruption, you know, where we're seeing technology-based disruption, where we're seeing companies that got a hold of the technology and used it as a way to re-architect an entire industry. And of course, the poster children for that are a lot of them right now are software companies. You know, that's Uber.
Uber and Lyft, yeah, right.
Yeah, and how many taxi companies could have just made an iPhone app, but didn't, you know? That's the story. You know, these companies replaced an entire industry with a startup. And so, you know, we're seeing that, you know, that's Airbnb with hospitality, that's Facebook with media. You know, these are all cases where the incumbent industry didn't have a functional relationship with innovation, and they didn't have a way of figuring out what was possible and how to reinvent what they did. So they got, you know, they lost out to, you know, more innovative type of company. And so anyway, those are kind of the forces in play. And, you know, when you take that and really start looking at, you know, what does this mean for humans? Well, what it means is we're in a renaissance right now. There are extraordinary new capabilities that are in the toolkit. And a lot of them still are coming from computers. But on top of the software we've had for a long time, we now have extraordinary superpowers from machine learning, from, you know, automation and robotics and the things that are really coming of age. And those give us a chance. I mean, they're very relevant technologies to almost any industry. And so when you look around, there's a lot of work to do reinventing almost every business, every industry, and taking these capabilities to go solve the problems we've ignored. You know, there's so many things about the world that could be better, but we stopped trying because we didn't have practical tools. And now we've got a lot of new capabilities that we could use to revisit some of those problems. And I'm talking about things like, how do you solve sanitation in the poorest countries in the world? How do you solve for energy? How do you solve for clean water? How do you eradicate the disease that's killing people off? These are all problems we solved in America because we're rich.
Right.
But these are not solutions that scale. So now that we, you know, don't have to worry about those things, I think there's a great opportunity for us to take our skills, our experience, our knowledge, our resources, and then aim it at solving some of these problems that are global in nature and not just things that we have going on here.
Let me ask you a big question about that challenge, because a lot of times the way Western democracies and the countries and cultures that use technology greatly today, the way they got to that point was a way in which we find ourselves with a warming atmosphere. We find a lot of problems associated with that, that whole curve to get to this point we are today. If the rest of the world, you know, the goal is to bring the rest of the world equal, they can't go through that same growth curve with the same utilization of natural resources.
Yeah.
So how do you solve that in a way in which they don't go through that huge curve?
Right. Well, that's a really great example, because when you look at the situation, you know, the difference between America and a lot of other countries, almost every other country, is that we just had essentially unlimited natural resources, right? And we were able to take advantage of that to build a very, you know, wealthy and functional economy. And at this point, it's still true. Americans use, I think it's about 9 times as much energy as the average person on Earth. Right. So, you know, the goal is not to give everybody a little bit more. The goal is to catch everyone else up. Right. The real goal is to get everyone on Earth as much energy as an American gets. And that's a big challenge. And the truth is, you know, they're going to get there if they got to burn coal to do it. And it would be very disingenuous for us to tell them not to. Right.
Right.
Because that's what we did. Right, we burned a lot of coal and gas to get where we are, and it's not really fair to say, oh, you don't get to do that. If you want to make an improvement on how we get the rest of the world up to our living standard, or at least a better one, and if you want to do it in a way that's fair and reasonable and carbon-free, well, then you have to deploy nuclear reactors. People just don't understand. Like, the only way that you can scale carbon-free energy is with nuclear reactors. We have no other technology that can do it at scale. And we're doing a lot, we're really distracting ourselves with a lot of other things, but the goal is much bigger than people realize or admit, and the only technology we have is fission that works. So to help, our job is go figure out how to make better reactors for the whole world.
And this is one of the things you've done, actually.
Well, it's one of the projects that we, at our lab, we invented a new type of nuclear reactor that's powered by nuclear waste. This is the first time anybody's taken a serious stab at developing a new reactor technology in our lifetime. You know, all of today's reactors were designed before we were born with, you know, with slide rules and pencils. We can do a lot better. That toolkit I was talking about has advanced quite a bit. We have large-scale computational modeling. We're able to go design a reactor with a lot more understanding of exactly what the properties of it are, and that makes us able to design modern, safe reactors that are more efficient. And so, you know, there's some work to do cleaning up the regulatory environment in the U.S. You know, we sort of outlawed reactors in the 80s, and so no one's been working on it. But now's the time to work on it. And we have our project, which is called TerraPower. That's going great. But, you know, we have, there should be 100 more. You know.
I know that this reactor project has a name, TerraPower, which suggests it's more than theoretical. But is it more is it more theoretical, or have you actually built actual models yet?
So everything about the reactor works in computational models.
Okay.
Right, where we're able to simulate the physics of what's going on in the reactor core and prove that it will work. But it's not like build an iPhone apps. It takes a long time. So we're about, I think, 12 years into it. We're, you know, hoping to build a test core, you know, sometime in the next decade, and prove that it all works, and then build commercial reactors after that. Unfortunately, we can't do it in the U.S. right now because of the regulatory environment. We had a deal to build a test core in China, but that deal is off now because of the so-called trade war, and so now we have to find a place to build a build a reactor.
And the idea, as you explained it in a video that I saw, it sounds very brilliant because it's not a high heat reactor, is it?
Well, it does make a lot of heat. Every reactor, you know, the way you get energy out of it is by making a lot of heat. The difference is that in today's reactors, what happens is you load them up with enriched uranium, right, which is a fissionable fuel. That's the glowing green stuff you see on The Simpsons. You know, that stuff's dangerous and radioactive, and it's a little scary because what happens is if those fuel rods aren't perfectly managed, they get a little too close together, which, you know, could happen in a earthquake or some extreme event. Well, they can start a runaway chain reaction, and that's where you get a meltdown like Chernobyl. And so we certainly never want that to happen again. So part of the job of designing modern reactors is to design reactors where that's impossible. And so what's cool about our reactor design, it's called a traveling wave reactor. And it starts with depleted uranium. That's the stuff left over in the stockpiles, left over from making bombs and making reactors. And we have a lot of that. And it contains about 93% of the energy that it started out with, because today's reactors aren't actually capable of getting most of the energy out. So the waste contains a lot of energy, but it's too depleted to sustain a fission reaction. It can't fission to make energy for us, and it also certainly can't melt down. But we put that in our reactor, and because of the reactor design, it's able to enrich the fuel and burn it. So the point of that is that there's never a critical mass of fissionable material. If something went wrong and there were an earthquake, the thing would just fizzle out. It wouldn't actually be able to melt down the way we saw in Chernobyl.
And this is an example of what you would call deep tech.
Yes, that's what I call deep tech. To be cheeky, I call everybody else's tech shallow tech. And by that, I mean, you know, iPhone apps and enterprise software and easy stuff.
But one of the things you say is there's really a dearth of that. There's not a whole lot of that taking place in the American economy now. It's all about something that, a software that you can make money with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. And that's why, in some sense, I think it's kind of easy for us. We don't have a lot of competition. You know, we're just inventing new technologies, all of which, come from maybe advanced physics or new areas in science or a lot of them are our ability to understand what's coming out of the scientific research community. But, you know, none of them are iPhone apps. And I think, iPhone apps have been great and we're getting a lot of mileage out of that. And certainly some people are making good products and good companies and getting rich and all that stuff. And that's great. But it's distracting everybody from the real potential that exists to bring new technologies into the world. And that's kind of what the Silicon Valley of the 80s did. You know, if you want to make a difference, you start with a new technology and you bring that into the world. So the way we think about it is we've sort of overdone it on celebrating entrepreneurs and supporting them and funding them. And, you know, we have billions and billions in venture capital available to fund a startup. But that doesn't really kick in until there's already a product and you're going to scale up a business. And there's funding for basic research. There probably should be more. But that's scientific research. That's trying to understand how the world works. In the middle, you've got this really important piece of the puzzle, which is called invention. And that's where you take the output of basic research and you apply it to solve a problem and create a new technology. That's invention. That's what we do. And sadly, you know, you probably don't know anybody besides me who has a business card that says inventor on it. It's not a legitimate career choice, you know. And so that's what we're trying to solve. And we're trying to separate those roles, get inventors supported so that they can do what it is that they're good at and get paid so they can keep doing it. And we can scale up, you know, humanity's ability to go after these big problems.
My guest today is Pablos Holman. He is a hacker, a tech futurist, an inventor. He's with the Intellectual Ventures Lab, and he'll be the next University of Tulsa presidential lecturer. And that takes place this evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the University of Tulsa campus. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I'd like to talk about some of the things that you've been doing, and everything from theoretical inventions that would mitigate the effects of huge hurricanes or global warming. To 3D food printing, but I want to talk about your work in alleviating malaria, which you've done in conjunction with the Gates Foundation. And of course, everybody wants to hear about the laser that kills malaria-bearing mosquitoes.
Right.
We can talk about that, but I'd really like to talk about some of the other things that you guys have been involved with that really are making a difference.
Sure. So we're very fortunate to get backing from Bill Gates. You know, he's asked us to work on invention for some of these problems in the developing world. And so we have a group at the lab called Global Good. And that group's entirely focused on problems that affect, you know, people in poor countries and in places where kids are dying. And so malaria is the low-hanging fruit in global health right now. You know, malaria is taking almost a million lives a year. Half of them are kids under 5 years old who never had a chance. We solved this problem in America, and we solved it in Southern Europe by spraying chemicals. That's what DDT was used for. DDT was what we used in the 40s and 50s to eliminate malaria here. It wasn't as big of a problem as it is in sub-Saharan Africa, and that's why that technology isn't good enough to solve the problem. It's just the best technology we had at the time. Spraying DDT basically just kills everything, and then you sort of hope the good stuff comes back to life and without the malaria. But it's pretty crude. So inventions like what we call the photonic fence, it's a laser that can find mosquitoes, and it actually is measuring their wing beat frequency, and from that we can tell what species the bug is and what gender, and then we can shoot it down with a lethal laser. It's super fun to imagine and to see, and we do that every day in the lab. But the key point about an invention like that is that it computes the value of the life of every bug before we shoot it down.
That's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's surgical. You know, we're just going after we don't even shoot the males. They don't carry malaria. It's only the females that bite you. They're getting your blood for reproduction. It's not actually food for them, it's for reproduction. So, you know, being able to just shoot female Anopheles defensi mosquitoes is a surgical approach to the problem. And that way, you know, we can let bees and butterflies go do their thing. And that's what I mean when I say, you know, these technologies give us the ability to go after these problems in a better way than we ever could in the past. But that one still, unfortunately, it did get a lot cheaper over the years since we first invented it, but the laser itself is still too expensive to use on a large scale the way we want to, so that one's taken some time. If any of your listeners can invent a better, cheaper laser, we would love to hear about it.
But tell us about the super thermos. Yeah. Tell us about the super thermos. Okay, this is something you have done.
So one of the other problems that you have, you know, we're running large-scale vaccination campaigns. You know, if you remember when you were a kid, your mom took you to the doctor, you got poked in the arm, and you got injected with vaccines for things like measles and the mumps and rubella and stuff like that. And so these are diseases that have long since been eradicated in America. We don't have these problems because we have you know, very comprehensive vaccination. In a lot of places in the developing world, what you have is a difficult time getting to every kid. But we try really hard. And so there are people out there, doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers out vaccinating kids. And they'll literally take, you know, $25,000 worth of vaccines, put them in a styrofoam cooler, you know, truck them out into rural Ethiopia or Senegal or one of these areas and start trying to find the kids who haven't been vaccinated and vaccinate them. That's the front lines of disease eradication. These are places where your life expectancy is half of what it is in America, and especially infant mortality is very, very high because these diseases, which are solvable, have not been solved. So one of the problems is that the vaccines are going bad. Vaccines are live cultures, and they have to be kept refrigerated. And you and I have refrigerators, and our doctors have refrigerators, and we have power to keep them running all the time. But the power is out 4 to 16 hours a day in a lot of these places. And what happens is the vaccines warm up, and then they go bad. There's no detection for that, so we're just injecting kids anyway. And with a bad vaccine. And so about 250,000 kids a year die of something that they were vaccinated against. So not even counting the kids who die of the disease otherwise, just the kids who we actually got to them, we actually vaccinated them, and it didn't work. And the reason is that vaccines didn't stay cold. So we invented this kind of super thermos. It's a very simple device. It's like, you know, like your thermos that you would use to keep soup hot or keep a drink cold. It's a little bigger, and you can put vaccines in there. And there's no external power, just like a thermos. There's no power cord. But you can come back a couple months later, and your vaccines will still be cold. It's a, you know, kind of a high-tech thermos that we invented. And it's used for transporting vaccines in sub-Saharan Africa and in a few countries. And that's been deployed for a few years now. We're hoping that it will get more popular and get used in more places. And we've actually since invented a couple of other products to improve what's called the cold chain for keeping vaccines cold. So we have a refrigerator that you can, that will stay cold for a week or two, even if the power goes out. And we have a small device that you could put on in a backpack and ride a bicycle out to carry vaccines to where you're doing your vaccination injections. And that thing's really cool. The way you recharge it is you just heat it up. So after it keeps things cool for I think it's about a day or so. And then you heat it up, and that recycles there's some pressurized fluid on the inside and then it'll stay cold for another day. So there's a bunch of really cool inventions that we've been able to come up with to help improve the way we're managing that cold chain and transporting the vaccines. And, you know, hopefully, you know, that's another 250,000 kids whose lives can be saved if you can just solve this one simple problem.
My guest today is Pablos Holman. He's a hacker, tech futurist, and inventor with the Intellectual Ventures Lab, and he'll be the next presidential lecturer tonight at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the TU campus, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We're just about out of time, but I do want to ask you, if the United States took a crash course and really encouraged this type of deep hacking invention, what would the country be capable of?
Oh, it's unimaginable. I mean, that's the thing. You know, you think about back in the days of like Isaac Newton, we didn't know a lot about how the world worked. Science hadn't given us a lot of answers yet. And someone like Isaac Newton could know pretty much everything in the world that was known about everything in science. You know, Newton knew all about physics and astronomy and biology and chemistry to the extent that was possible in that day. And it's just because there wasn't much that was known. And that's why someone like him was able to be so prolific in his discoveries. But today, we know a lot. And it's impossible for anybody to keep up on every area in science. There's so much that we know. And then we have all these incredible tools. We can measure almost anything. We've got all kinds of sensors. We've got networks to bring that data back to giant supercomputers that we can use to analyze the data. So, you know, the first time humans did things, we just had to make it work. You know, like when we built the railroads, just throw a lot of steel at it. Well, now we can measure everything. We can design for efficiency. We can design for the entire life cycle. We can make a product where, you know, everything from the moment we manufacture it to when we sell it to when we take it apart and recycle the components, we can plan for all that and make everything better. So there's a lot of amazing work to do. You know, I think we're really behind on both invention and we're behind on taking advantage of the inventions we do have and commercializing them, right? Because entrepreneurs are so fixated on making a business and growing it fast that they often forget to start out with a new technology.
Well, we'll be interested to hear more about what you're working on at the presidential lecture. Pablos, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
Pablos Holman is a hacker, tech futurist, and inventor with the Intellectual Ventures Laboratory, and he'll be the next presidential lecturer tonight at 7:30 in a free lecture at the Reynolds Center on the University of Tulsa campus. You can learn more at utulsa.edu. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.